It's my pleasure to introduce one of my co-voyagers in the history of this organization, and going way back, not to the beginning, but close. Paul Hansen has an enviable record of scholarship as well as service. He's been at Butler University since 1984. He's been the dean of the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, the department head, and other offices. He's very prolific. I only want to mention three of his half a dozen or more major publications: Contesting the French Revolution, Oxford, 2009; The Jacobin Republic Under Fire, The Federalist Revolt and the French Revolution, and Provincial Politics in the French Revolution, Caen et Limoges, 1789 to 1794. Certainly the last two broke a lot of important scholarly ground. Paul.
So we've covered a lot of ground in the last 45 minutes to an hour and a half here, and I'm going to try and keep my comments short so that we can get to some questions and discussion. In fact, I'm not quite sure that I'm fully up to the task of addressing the broad range of subjects that our three speakers have enlightened us about this morning. In regard, I'm just going to take the papers one by one in the order that they were presented. I found Scott's paper really fascinating in talking about the way that really the two sides, I suppose you might say, in the Algerian conflict are both trying to make use of the French revolutionary tradition to sort of support their goals and what they were trying to accomplish there. One can understand, I think, conservative army leaders conflating the revolutionary army of the Napoleon with the Napoleonic army, as we saw in one of the quotations that Scott put up here on the board. But clearly the two were quite different animals. By 1960, it seems to me, as the revolutionary certainly in Algeria thought about the revolutionary army, they would have been thinking principally about the People's Liberation Army in China, which perhaps one could compare to the French Revolutionary Army of 1792-93, but beyond that, it seems to me the army, even in the context of the revolution, changed into a much more professional organization. I found the discussion of Chacoutin fascinating. I had not ever encountered this fellow before, and he seems very curious, interesting, also wide-ranging. One thing that Chacoutin seems not to have mentioned in the passages that Scott quoted to us was the presence of propaganda organs with troops at the front. Certainly in the French Revolution, there were newspaper printing presses that accompanied the troops out into the field. Here, too, we might note the Chinese example. It was, after all, the People's Liberation Army, where Mao's Little Red Book was first distributed in the 1960s. I was struck by a couple of passages that Scott shared with us, and I want to go back to one in particular. You quoted General Allard at one point, who said, "It is not out of the question to presume that in the thinking of the Kremlin master, the process of contamination would not stop at the whole of the Black Continent, but also across the Atlantic and infiltrate the Americas." I mean, this is classic Cold War rhetoric, of course, but I wonder if we should also read that phrase as explicitly racist, if that's what he intended, or if it's simply the way we read it today. Boy, what do I have to say here about our paper about the Anglo world in interpreting the French Revolution. Lots of fascinating material here. I was struck, this was not in the written paper, the reference to the historiographical Sasquatch. Being from the Pacific Northwest, I appreciated that, I guess. You talked some, and as I listened to the paper, I heard you saying something a little bit different about the issue of textbooks. It does strike me that we have several people here at the conference who have written both the broad synthetic textbooks and not abandoned their commitment to producing monographs over their careers. We found that less among the English historians. I think you're right about that. I wonder if, in addition to the different models of professionalization and expectations for tenure, the sort of pattern or current of textbook production has not also been a factor of the publishing market in the United States and the pressure or the invitation from publishers to some of our colleagues to produce textbooks that sell in large numbers to that expanding population of college students in the United States in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. One name that you didn't mention today in your comments, John, was David Pinkney, who at one of these meetings in the 1970s, when I was still in graduate school, proposed what he called the Pinkney thesis, which was that in an age when faculty members were having families, when we were broadening the demography, the demographic spectrum, that it was simply going to be difficult for Americans to go to the archives to do the kind of history that all of us read in graduate school. And he sort of predicted an age in which we would see a different model, I think, which proved not to be the case as things turned out. But the advantage of being just across the channel from France for those British historians maybe proved not to be quite as insurmountable for American scholars as we might have thought back in the 60s. You mentioned the coolness of Anglo-empiricists to social theory. Certainly true. I thought of Jack's mentor, Robert Forster, though, on this side of the Atlantic, who was also quite skeptical of applying social theory to the empirical study of history. And by contrast, a name that you didn't mention, who I think had an enormous influence on that generation of American historians, was Charles Tilly, who certainly pushed a lot of us both to think in theoretical terms, but also, like Cobb, to get into the archives. Again, you noted and you did stress that one has to be nuanced here, but in drawing broad strokes, I think you emphasized the degree to which that generation of English historians who studied with Cobb and Cobbin were opposed to the Marxist interpretation of the French Revolution. I guess as I think about the work of someone like Alan Forrest and certainly Colin Jones, I mean, I wouldn't call Alan a Marxist, to be sure, but I don't see Alan's work as taking on that Marxist interpretation either. And Colin, I think, was often quite sympathetic to it. Michael, you're talking about things that I know very little about, but I have a couple of thoughts here about what you had to say to us about François Furet and the École des Hautes Études. I guess the you dove down into a lot of detail in the paper, and maybe in your initial comment here, you might share with us your overall sense of Furet's impact as the leader of the École in those 8 years. Did he have a positive effect on the École going forward? Was the legacy of Furet a substantial one? You went back and forth a lot in your comments about the neoliberal angle, whether we should think of Furet as adopting that ideology. As you discussed that, I couldn't help but think about the sort of perennial Republican threat in the United States to funding for the National Endowment for the Humanities and the National Endowment for the Arts. One can certainly make the argument that losing public funding can be a good thing, that it pushes us to do more creative thinking and to be more independent. One can also take the opposite argument, I think, which would be the one that I would take, that it's absolutely crucial to maintain that public funding in order to keep the vitality of these kinds of institutions and their public role in front of us. So those are my thoughts. Again, thank you for 3 wonderful papers. We've all learned a lot this morning. And let's have a good discussion now.
Thank you. Well, we have 15 minutes. Can the panelists... Excuse me.
can the panelists can move their chairs over here and so that they can face
The music.
can they move?
Just stand
yeah.
But,
huh? Well, not in the near. Well, it just seems.
I will face the firing squad.
So, there you go. That's all three. I'll let Paul be the cop here.
Oh, thanks.
Okay. Well,
thanks.
Just call on people.
Yeah, call on people.
We have a microphone.
There you go.
For questions. Yeah. Do you want to just turn to them directly?
Okay, absolutely.
Let's do that.
Yeah. For me,
anyway.
For the room, it's just for the recording.
Robbie.
Because we don't have much time, but I just want to address one of the papers on Furet. I can't contest anything you've said. I have some experience with the Ecole. I also have to say I had some personal experience with François Furet in Michigan, mostly in the tennis court, but otherwise as well. And the other thing I would make is that one of the things that impressed me about him, and he took from Brodel this lesson, although I don't think he needed that, was his entrepreneurial spirit and his not only his pro-Americanism, but his deep knowledge of the American political and academic scene. In that sense, you know, he was a visitor at Michigan and Johns Hopkins and elsewhere, Princeton.
Chicago.
He had a position in the 80s. But he learned how to sort of play a certain academic game in terms of getting funding, in terms of tapping foundations. Really, I think that's one of the lessons he took from his experience of America, getting outside the sort of state-sponsored context and institutions and sort of creating ad hoc institutions, tapping funding and the like.
Oh, I can do this part. I can deliver the mic. That was neat.
Hi, Gary Cates, Pomona College. I actually have questions for each of the panelists. Scott, on your paper regarding the legacy of the French Revolution in later revolutionary struggles, can you provide a larger context for us of how Algeria fits in with other post-World War II legacies? What I have in mind is something like this, and I'm going to do it in a very pedestrian way, and I'd like you to look at this a little more critically. That what interests me is the word revolution drops out at a certain point. And it seems to me, and it's very much in usage in your period, but then in the 1980s, and of course at the end of the 80s in Europe, we have all these revolutionary moments, but they're never called revolution. They have to be qualified like velvet revolution, which is an oxymoron in a way, and especially in the kind of violent struggles that you're talking about. It seems to me that the Iranian Revolution of 1979 somehow killed off the usage of the word revolution. I'd like your insights on that or this context of revolutionary legacy. John, I'm so taken with your project, and especially with kind of institutionalizing and thinking of historiography in terms of generations of institutions and professionalization. In 1973, my first course as a college junior at Brandeis University on the French Revolution used James Thompson's synthesis, The French Revolution. You haven't mentioned him. He's British. The book was published in 1943. I used that book quite successfully beginning in 1980, 7 years later, when I began teaching at Trinity University. And I only stopped using it when it went out of print, which was about the same time Sharma published Citizens in 1989. I wonder if you know anything about that book, its influence, its popularity, and the tradition it comes out of. Finally, Michael Christofferson, we have former deans here in Paul and in Jack, and actually I was a dean at Pomona College. So I think we all sympathized with, and maybe there are others in the room who I'm not noticing, we all sympathize with the intellectual becoming administrator and finding oneself up against severe budget constraints. I would like you too to put this in a larger framework. I'm trying to think of, we all know that there are transformative administrators out there, like Robert Hutchins at the University of Chicago, that are famous for, we all know that there are transformative intellectuals. Who else should we be thinking of besides Furé, who is an intellectual who might have become a transformative administrator in higher education? Should we think of our own, in our own American tradition, the librarians of Congress in this way, or is that absurd? I'm trying to get a sense of, when I weigh Furé, when we think about the polarity between ideology and budget constraint as navigating through higher education administration, what models should we have in mind?
We're all stressed about the poverty of Pomona. Wow, that's something. Why don't we let each guy have a quick stab, because each answer could consume the few minutes we have left. So please confine. Who wants to go first? John, you're Scott?
Sure.
Somebody.
So, I mean, I think the larger context is an interesting question. It's what I'm interested in more generally. And so I think you're right about the timing. Before the Algerian War, and before the 40s in particular, there's no discussion of North Africa as being a place where revolution could occur, unless it's a material revolution, technological revolution. And so my broader project is mapping out the sort of context in which, how does it become possible to all of a sudden, early in the Algerian War, to say this is an Algerian revolution? And then what does that mean? So they're seeing Algerians as revolutionary at this moment, whereas previously, in other nationalist violent moments, they wouldn't. I think your question about the trajectory of why it drops out at a certain period is, I think people get a little uncomfortable with the series of third worldist revolutions and where they lead. And so they're just less willing to think of massive political change on that revolutionary model. I mean, Michael's early work talks about this in great detail. And I think you have a succession of moments of excitement, like Algeria, they're then overcome with disappointment, after you have the coup a couple years after the Algerian War, and people think, well, maybe Algeria wasn't what we hoped it would be. And then the same thing happens with revelations continual about China, Russia. And then, you get people like Foucault really excited that maybe Iran would be different. And then it seems to repeat this predictable narrative that middle or right-wing critics say, no, of course, if it's a revolution, it's going to be bad. And it's going to end up in these authoritarian, Napoleonic type ways. So I think briefly that's how I'd answer that question. But with each case, it's really specific. If you look at smaller examples like Indochina, for instance, people don't call it a revolution until you get to Dien Bien Phu. And then people sort of concede, okay, yeah, this was a revolution rather than just a war to keep the empire.
Terse answers. Either one.
Want to go in order?
Doesn't matter. Okay. Gary, just email me and I'll tell you everything you want to know about Reverend Thompson. Okay. The fact that Reverend Jack McManers, no doctoral students, what did they do? They took secondary source work and they made it for textbooks for A levels and such. It was, and if you take a look at it, it's very, very empiricist and descriptive,
yeah.
Is it not?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's part of the tradition. On textbooks, again, there's so much here for the appendices. The idea is that it's not it planned. Isser Woolock told me, John, I never planned not to do a textbook, but you had to do the monograph. So it's only in the mid-1990s that we get the pushback of Jack and Lynn and Popkin and such. How that textbook market works, absolutely. And even the change of Western Civ from the single-authored Western Civ to the three, four authored Western Civ. Absolutely. Whereas for the English model, the individual authored synthesis with state-supported publishers, yes, absolutely. The way that the publishers are going to drive this is going to be hugely important. One thing I do want to emphasize, however, especially since we're being recorded here, the list that I gave you of all those PhD students, of course they're not a common block. Gwyn Lewis is a radical. Bob Darton is Bob Darton. The Cobbins students are such. But if you look at the mean, if you look at the average, and you think about who are the tough revisionists who write books, Doyle, Baker, and such, they come out of a tradition that's very different than Scani, Berkeley, Stanford, Columbia in the 60s and 70s. So there's that. So we have to recognize the differences, including in the specific Commonwealth states. And those are kind of just the big thing. But most of all, everyone, anybody who got a thesis done from the 60s to the 80s, test it. You know, think about the ideas. You're all part of that living history. And all I'm really asking is if we can get rid of the Anglo-Saxon myth, we really have some interesting rethinking to do about how we think about how historiography is uncoiled. And the importance of Western Civ. If Western Civ is gone, and we don't have that meta-narrative anymore, how do we fit our research into that big estuary where we want all that research eventually to flow?
I just wanted to say something that just will be curious, you'll enjoy. The censor, or should I say Hunt censor, textbooks came out of, we wanted to do the website, and when the textbook in our mind was a handbook to get into the website. I mean, we never desired to write a textbook. We desired to, what could you do with images? And we found that we needed a carrier, and it sold a lot more copies than even Lynn Hunt is used to selling because of the use by you in that classroom of LEF.
Okay, well, thank you, everybody, for your thoughts and comments. Just quickly, in response to Rob, I totally agree with you that, you know, Furé had this entrepreneurial spirit, and partly, you know, he's learning, you know, different ways of being an academic entrepreneur from his experiences in America. The other questions, Paul asked about Furé's overall impact on the Ecole, and Gary about, how Furé compares to other transformative administrators, or what would we learn if we put him in that context. And my intention with this paper, I'm trying to write a book on Furé that is about his politics and his history writing, and I'd done all this research in these archives. I was even thinking of not writing about this topic, but I came to the conclusion that this was actually very important to understanding kind of the other aspects of him. Yes, he had an impact on the Ecole. Obviously there is, the founding of the Raymond Aron Institute, and the turn towards political history, I think, is probably the most significant one. I'm more interested in trying to explain what I think is, often the discussions of Furé just sort of assume that, beginning with Ponce de la Révolution Française, if not earlier, his politics was the same, his intentions were the same. And I don't think that's the case. I think he evolved significantly over the course of his career, and this story of his place as, or his role as an administrator, is part of that evolution. It's an attempt at me, by my part, to get at how he's his attitudes and his approaches to history are changing, and partly it has to do with the institutions within he works. I think even more important in some respects is what I was saying about the labor issue. You can't do those projects anymore without the temporary workers, and they just, all these, like lire écrire, these required huge resources. In fact, he was even more of an entrepreneur in the sense, by linking up with the University of Michigan, which got NEH grants, hundreds of thousands of dollars, to digitize all of this data from the Statistique Générale de la France to do lire écrire. So you know, I'm trying to understand, well, okay, he's working with these institutions, these institutional constraints. How does the shift in the institutions potentially shift his or relate to shifts in his politics and his history writing? And so some of the other issues I really haven't thought about, although, you know, maybe they would help me understand the larger issues I'm engaging.
There's a lot of pent-up energy for talking. We're going to have another session coming in here. The coffee is there. I urge you, and I'm going to do this myself, to buttonhole these guys and ask questions, because I do think there's a lot out there. And I want to thank the panelists for stimulating the panel.